36 people in 3 months. It's been bunkers.
Have you got any help? Is it just you doing it, or have you got other people there?
It's me now. Yeah.
Oh, so you need to recruit some more recruiters, basically, Charlotte. That's what you need to do.
I need a recruiter and a talent coordinator.
Yeah.
I can hear myself echoing. Do you hear that too?
A little bit, yeah. I wonder whether you're probably picking up something from your own voice, so to speak. So, maybe you got two windows open or something on the browser.
That could be the case.
Yeah. So get rid of that.
Yeah.
And we should be
got
good.
It.
Yeah, I do that. I do that also. So it's not just you. All right, listen, we're live, everybody. So welcome to Brain Food Live on Air, folks. It is episode 128. 128 of these things we've done. That's got to be like 3 years worth plus of Brain Food Lives every Friday. So we're bringing it to you every week. And I hope you're enjoying these shows and I hope you're getting stuff out of it. And we've got a very interesting one to talk about today, because we're going to try and get a little bit more of a deeper understanding of the psychology behind unconscious or subconscious bias, because it is something that we recruiters care about. But I wonder whether we have a pretty superficial understanding of what this is. And I think sometimes we may be implementing things that are counterproductive because our understanding is so superficial. So I'll be very interested to dive into that with you guys as well. Okay, before we begin, though, as always, we do a sound check. So let's just quickly check on this. Firstly, we're on Crowdcast. So if everyone can hear me on Crowdcast, please say hello. Can you hear me okay? Is audio fine? I've got to be honest, I'm not sure my audio is okay either. It sounds a bit strange. But let me know if you can hear me okay on Crowdcast. We are multicasting on LinkedIn, I hope. If you can see me on LinkedIn, give me a thumbs up. Let me know whether you can hear me okay. I screwed up massively on Wednesday, by the way. There was a blank screen projected out for 12 minutes on LinkedIn. So I apologize for anybody who had to go through that. So I'm now super paranoid. If you can hear me on LinkedIn, though, please let me know, because I'm monitoring that like a hawk now. And I'll fiddle with some knobs over there if you can't see this okay. We're also should be punching this out on the Facebook group as well. So if you're watching this on Facebook, let me know if the audio is okay. I think we're okay. Not much we can do about it anyway. All right. Quick shout out to our sponsors this week. It's Brick, brick.com. They've been like such an awesome supporter of Brain Food, not only Brain Food Live, but other Brain Food channels as well. They're going to extend their sponsorship in 2022 as well. So you're going to see a lot more about this business. They're in this frame. They're all trying to figure out how do we hire better in a fairer and equitable way. So definitely check out Brick if you have the chance. We've also got the psychologist in from Brick to talk to us later on today, because she's a trained psychologist and we're going to get some good info from her. Okay, firstly, let's welcome Charlotte. Charlotte, I can't pronounce your second name.
Mozart. Yes.
Mozart. Good Lord. It just intimidates me whenever I see it. When you hear it, it sounds like you can do it. But when I look at it, I think, I need someone to totally guide me through this one.
My dad always used to say, just say Mozart. And I was like, well, it sounds a bit weird, right? So let's just stick to Mozart.
I wonder whether, is it actually the Dutch version of Mozart? Is it?
Definitely not. No.
No?
No. Absolutely not. No.
Okay. So for the folks who don't know you, Charlotte, can you quickly introduce yourself, who you are, what it is you do?
Yeah, sure thing. Charlotte, head of talent / people at Lendable, fintech that focuses on loans, micro lending, basically. Incredibly busy. They just became unicorn in March, and I'm hiring a talent coordinator, by the way, guys, if you're keen, please apply. That, yes, 36 people hired in the last 3 months, and gonna hire additional 40 to 50 next 3 months. So
crazy,
busy,
crazy, crazy, crazy times. Yeah. You should post your job on Brain Food Jobs, by the way.
We have a
job board now.
It looks amazing. I checked it out.
Yeah, so bang it up there. Okay, let's firstly, we always review the newsletter, Charlotte. And I know you've been super busy, so I just wonder if you haven't read it, you can totally say, yeah, I haven't read it, no worries.
I've scanned it, as I usually do. And one of the things was the productivity that was very interesting. And I was wondering, how many hours do you work a week?
How interesting was this? That was super, super interesting, wasn't it? Let me just say, this is from Atlassian. So they, you know, kind of did a study on, okay, what is the optimal amount of time people actually do in the world of work? And there were some really interesting findings here. And I, the thing I found most interesting about this was that the people who claimed that they felt overly stressed with work didn't have significantly larger amount of time committed to work than the people who said they had loads of time. There was only about an hour's difference. So the folks that basically said, look, I'm totally stressed out, I'm maxed out, they basically reported 8.6 hours per day on their five-day working week. Quite a large, big number, I would say, in terms of hours committed. But the folks who said, listen, I got plenty of time, said 7.6 hours. So you're only saving 5 hours. So can managers like make it like dramatically better by just like taking 5 hours off somewhere, you know? Crazy. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know. I tend to think about working as in I need to get done what I need to get done. And I try to get it done within the amount of time. So if I have an hour left, that's amazing. But if you need to work longer, then I'm fine with that as well. I think I'm above the 50 hours a week, which basically said that your productivity falls after 50 hours a week. So right, that was interesting. I was like, I need to be more aware, you know.
And there's another thing there. It falls at 50 hours, but then it collapses after 55 hours. So you like it's almost like you can keep going on fumes between 50 and 54 hours or so. You can kind of just strain your way through it. But then your brain, something shuts down and it's like pointless being there 56, 57, 70 hours, whatever. It's all waste. It's just gas. It's like nothing's going on productively. And I think mistakes will increase as well. And tolerance goes down. I think your communication with your colleagues will probably become worse and poorer. All kinds of negative things will start seeping into your activity if you kind of go too hard too often, I think.
I was wondering in the group, how many hours do people work on a weekly basis?
They're watching Brain Food Live on Friday at 2. They're not doing much more than 30 hours a week in any of them. Do you know what I mean? There's no chance. we're attracting folks that understand work-life balance. Is that right, lads? No. But actually, it's an interesting question. What is your average working week? You know, obviously everyone is kind of pushing forward and we need to strain at times, but other times, you know, it's a little bit slacker. So is it at the 40 plus? Is it at 36 or 38? You know, how many hours are you working? Be interesting to know. I think we're probably moving upwards with the amount of work recruiters have and our lack of ability to hire recruiters, I think is definitely going to be nudging it higher than it should be. Okay, read that Atlassian link. It was really interesting. There's also deeper bits of research as well in there that's worth checking out. So please make sure you take a look. Give us another one from last week, Charlotte.
Employee referral, the median, that was between 500 and 1,000 pounds. That was very interesting. I think it's very cheap. It's a big discussion at Lendable at the moment. Like, what should we offer?
How much?
It's a difficult one. Engineering, 5,000.
Okay.
However, operations, 500.
Oh, wow. So there's a big like difference in terms
gap.
Of... Yeah.
And I
can see why, though.
But
I can
still
see why, though. Because it's about the how hard it is to recruit, I
guess.
Scarcity
of skill set, basically. But it just still feels wrong somewhere. It's more of a moral thing, I guess. But we're trying... Data science is 3,000. So basically, the scarcer the job, the more money we would pay for an internal referral.
Yeah, that's interesting. So folks, for the people who don't know this, this is a state of referral schemes by a company called Firstbird, which is an Austrian startup that is a referral scheme company. Cool product, by the way. And they did this survey. And one of the interesting slides in the survey was actually what the average size of the referral was. This is all in euros. So I'm guessing it was a European-ish sample. But I was surprised that the median, meaning the most popular referral size, was 500 to 1,000 euro, which I thought that was like super stingy. You know, if you're an employee, you've actually referred someone in, they've got a job, you get 500 euro for that. I'm thinking, it needs to be like higher, a lot higher. You know?
But what also could happen is if you pay a higher fee, that people go sourcing for other people, which is happening at our company at the moment.
Is that bad though?
I don't know. Is it? Is it if the quality of the candidate is good, but we don't want people to do our jobs in a way.
Oh, super interesting. That is another Brain Food Live. That right there is another Brain Food Live. What are the negative effects of paying way too much as a referral scheme? Like, do you get like engineers deciding, you know what, it's easy for me to make 5K every time, I'm going to stop coding for a bit.
And, exactly. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. 5K is probably big enough for you to do it on one intro, especially if you've got a decent network and you can kind of make that happen. So that's like, I didn't even think about that actually, because I'm always thinking just elevate it. But it stops becoming a passive referral, and then it becomes like an active. This person's actually on LinkedIn, he's literally spending time doing this. Crazy.
It happened with a guy. An example would be that we went sourcing together and I found this person and he said, no, I wouldn't hire him. And then 2 weeks later, I was like, should we hire him? I was like, what? You just mentioned you didn't want to. He said, like, do I get a referral bonus for that? I was like, no, because she said you didn't want me to reach out to him because he wasn't a potential hire. So I was you know, it's reverse psychology happening. I was like, okay, hold on.
So this is interesting. So this now gets even like dangerous politically, doesn't it?
Yeah,
like it does. Who owns the referral? You know, at what point do you activate? Let's say I introduce someone, it's a no first time round. 6 months later, there's a different job. You hire that person. Do I make a claim? do you know what I mean?
It's we can talk about this for hours.
Yeah, yeah. Suddenly you need to implement like T's and C's, like a proper T's and C's for your employees, otherwise you're going to get these sort of disputes. This is fascinating. Okay, we need to do that show. Okay, give us one more before we move on to the meat of this topic. One more thing from last week.
The greatest resume you've ever
seen. Yeah, amazing, right?
Yeah, just it's so well written. It's such an interesting concept, and I think it's an example that more people should follow.
What an amazing story. So folks, I just wanted to I shared the link in the chat stream there. Please do read this story. I don't even know whether it's true or not, because it's one of those where it's so funny. You think someone's just written this out. This is like, it's too good to be true. But basically, there's this company that has decided to recruit people by completely ignoring their CV and even ignoring their background. Long story short, he's recruiting for a cloud engineer. He hired this guy who was a plumber, and simply on the basis of the fact that doing plumbing had the right sort of ability to think about solving, looking at complex systems, troubleshooting, you know, where a blockage was. He just looked at it and thought, right, actually, it's a very similar skill set in terms of your mental skills. The big difference is simply the topic area, and you could fill that in simply by, you know, education. And apparently this guy got the job. So that's an amazing story, but also tells you the idea, and it kind of leads on to where we're going now, is that we can't have these preconceptions necessarily about who and what can do what jobs. It's like, it's what the skills are, and they may be able to apply and transfer to other places. And having a preconception is not necessarily gonna help you with that. And this is important when you have a candidate shortage and you can't actually recruit. Guess what? You're gonna have to start looking at people that are outside of your, you know, core catchment area. Anyway, let's move on to the topic of the show, which is subconscious bias. How would you use this? Subconscious, unconscious, Charlotte? I mean, you've got some background in this topic, don't you?
Unconscious bias, I would say.
You would say this. What are your thoughts on this? The psychology behind it? Why do we have unconscious bias? I mean, is there a reason why we as human beings kind of have this? It seems like it's a plague. So why do we have it?
It's more of an connecting the dots thing, really. So basically A and B make C. So basically we want to assess the situation. You're like, I assume. So you basically fill in the gaps already without even having asked this person, what do you think or how do you feel about it? The same bias when it comes to skin color or you know, if someone wears glasses or not. You know, people are assumed to wear glasses are nerds or more intelligent. It's very interesting how the brain works and basically creates these assumptions in your brain already beforehand. Yeah, it's something that I try to be very conscious of my bias, but it makes it basically impossible because you constantly reflect, like, did I just make up something, rather than asking the person or assessing truly if this person behaves in a certain way, if you, you know, if you interview for attributes. It's a difficult topic, and it's never ending.
That is actually a really good point, because if we're always checking ourselves, right? If we're always checking ourselves, we'd never actually get anything done. You know, like, how do we know the opinion we've derived is free from bias? I mean, even our confidence that it is free from bias may itself be a bias. You know, we might be a biased on our own sort of self-perception or something.
Exactly. So, and it went even so far that one of the engineers said, when he was interviewing, he said, I can see the name. Why don't we give the candidate a number? And that felt really weird, wrong in a way. I was like, well, that's an option, but we're not going to go there. And it's interesting how people try to think along, like, oh, but maybe we could do this or could do that. I think there was a video with regards to a person playing violin, and based on the stamping of her feet on the actual audition, they would assume it would be a girl or a man. So there was an unconscious bias because they heard the click clacking of the heels. So they said no to a person doing the audition because they sensed it was a woman and they wanted a man in their heads. So that's how far ago. It was a blind audition, but they could hear it.
Wow. Any bit of it. You just reminded me as well, two things that are interesting you've said there. Please remind me, by the way, folks, if we don't come back to this. But firstly, some of the techniques that we've deployed are kind of dehumanizing, aren't they? The idea of putting a number against somebody, eliminating their name, which, you know, we do a lot in terms of, you know, the anonymization, and that's one of the techniques. But is that, like, we are dehumanizing people. I mean, that's, we're trying to get rid of that. So we might then be moving down a path which it does feel uncomfortable for reasons we need to explore. And the second thing you mentioned was that these other cues that you have, you know, especially the clopping of high heels, it does trigger something. You know, it's actually used in films quite a lot, where, you know, you want to try and create an entrance, typically of a woman figure. The clopping of the heels is actually one of the things that tells you in advance of seeing it that, yeah, you know what, the female lead is coming on, or something, you know, interesting is happening, and it's a female character moving onto screen. You don't hear that from a man, and it's kind of connecting our awareness that men and women in Western world, modern world, wear different shoes. So very, very interesting. Okay, let's bring in our guests. Let's get a four of us on screen here, and we'll just get on with it and see how we go. So we're going to go, let's see if we can bring on, yes, Evie's there. Let's bring her on. And I think Dr. Stephen is here as well. Stephen Smith, there he is. Let's try and bring these two on, and cross fingers. We have, oh, here we go. There's Hi. Evie.
Hi, how nice are you, to meet Evie? You. I'm doing great. Nice to see you. Thank you for having us today.
No, great to have you. Thanks for stepping in and being like a psychological expert here, Evie. For the people who don't know you, can you quickly intro yourself?
Of course. So my name is Evie, and I am the in-house, or Evie, you can call me Evie, it's okay. I'm used to calling me Evie. I was in the UK for years. So I am the in-house IO psychologist at Brick. I work there for the last 1 year, and we help and we support our customers to make better hiring for the future.
Okay, fantastic. I think I've got to re-invite Stephen there. For some reason, that's not happened. Okay, I think that should work. Thank you very much, Evie. So whilst we try and get Stephen on, let's just get on with this conversation. A couple of interesting things we've already talked about. It might be worthwhile just putting a baseline for the audience in terms of where you think we're at with regards to our understanding of unconscious bias. Because one of the concerns I have always is that sometimes in HR, we take a concept from an academic field or from a different field, and we just assume we understand it and we just charge ahead. Whereas actually, you know, there's lots more stuff we need to know. So where do you think we are in terms of our understanding of unconscious bias, Evie? How would you characterize the state of our understanding of it in HR and TA?
I think that the understanding and the awareness of being biased is the first step to remove them. We can reduce them. However, we can eliminate them. So it is important for everyone to understand that we are all biased. Unfortunately, we receive 11 million information at every single moment, every single second, not moment, and we are able to consciously process only 40 of them. So everything
step back, Evie. What do you mean 11 million of what and 40 of what?
Information. So every single second, our brain is receiving 11 million of information, of new information.
Bits of information, basically.
Exactly. So it's really difficult to process this information. Our brain has created these shortcuts in order to make decisions. And these are the biases that we refer. So we need to understand that this happens to everyone. We are 99% biased.
Yeah. And we actually need this, don't we? Because if we were trying to actually process 11 million bits of information every single second, would, in fact, there's people struggle with this. We're talking about people who have, you know, different ways of thinking about the world. A lot of the times, their inability to function is optimally is because they're trying to overprocess this information. So we need the shortcuts in order to get through some of this thing. We can't basically spend the time and energy processing all of this.
Exactly. And you know, our brain automatically tell us when we're safe, because this comes from the evolutionary perspective. So we feel safe with people that they look, they feel, and they're similar to us. So this is a process of us feeling safe for the first person, and these shortcuts help us to survive. So they're coming from the evolutionary perspective.
Yeah, so even I guess animals have this, right? I mean, it's basically instinct. If a dog, you see a dog and you make a loud noise, the dog's going to cower away. It's not going to like rationally assess the situation. This is unusual. It's like a sudden impact noise. I'm out of here. You know, that bias is, I guess, selected for from an evolutionary perspective, because the dog that did stop and just had a look probably would have got shot, I guess. right. So there's in other words, there's evolutionary purpose to a lot of the cognitive shortcuts that we have. But it might be that these shortcuts are now, if you like, maladaptive to a lot of the things that we're trying to do, particularly when we're recruiting people into our organizations. What's your favorite? Go ahead, Charlotte.
I had a question. What is the biggest assumption regarding bias? What do you think? What's your opinion?
I feel the fact that we can eliminate them, it's wrong. And we feel that we can work on them. However, we need to be aware of them and have the perfect tools and the you know, the mechanism and the strategies that will help us to reduce them in every day and in the hiring process.
Very interesting. So, Evie, what you're saying is the biggest bias is actually the perception that it can be removed.
Exactly.
and that's wrong. Like, the first thing we have to accept is that you can't entirely debias it. And even the word bias itself is kind of connotes the wrong term, doesn't it? Because it connotes it as being like a super negative thing.
Exactly. We're biased even with words. Right. And we link them. Yeah.
Yeah, where it's just, you know, it's a shortcut we needed to have. So there we go. I think we've got Dr. Stephen Smith with us.
Eventually. Sorry, technology is a wonderful thing. Can you hear me?
We can hear you great.
Thank God for that.
I saw you, Stephen, and I kind of invited you, and then I had to reject
punching my computer. I'm biased against this blinking IT. That's what I'm biased against.
There we go. There we go. Well, Dr. Stephen Smith, I wonder whether you could quickly introduce yourself and what it is you do, sir.
Well, it's very kind of you to say I'm a doctor, because I'm not. I was actually in med school at St. Andrews a long time. I'm a chartered psychologist. I'm chartered in two areas. So I'm chartered in sports psychology. So I work with elite teams and organisations. And I'm also chartered as an occupational psychologist. Well, I work with large organisations in terms of their people. And I think a lot of what I'm going to say is maybe already been said in the I got snippets. And in terms of these, it's very interesting. People call unconscious bias. I don't think unconscious bias is actually the problem half the time. It's conscious bias that's the problem. But we'll come back to that. The basic thing is that when you look at the brain, and we talked about the evolutionary stages of the human brain, you can basically put it into three big evolutionary stages. The base of your neck, your reptilian. In the middle, you've got the next great big evolutionary stage, which is mammalian. And then the last big evolutionary stage is that huge big chunk of brain that wraps around everything else. And that's your human primate brain. The only part of your brain that you can interact with is that human primate brain. The other two are completely subconscious, and yet they probably dominate about 80% of our decisions about everything. And therefore, we have an issue. Because that mammalian brain in particular, it is driving you to two things. One is to survive. Don't get eaten. That's a bad thing. So you can breed. And two, make sure that you can eat so you can breed. One of the things that it looks for, and it's linked to the reptilian brain, is differences. So it's a difference machine. People who are from England will understand right away that I am Scottish, because they can hear the Scottishness in my accent.
Pretty but clearly, people, Stephen, I think so.
Ah, you think that. But people in Scotland will say, oh, you sound very English, because they know their brain has been trained as to what a genuine Scottish accent is, and mine's isn't one anymore. Mine's is a whole mix of my time in Scotland, my time at St Andrews, which was very English, and then my time down in England. So their brain picks up on all the things in my accent, which in their mind aren't right, they're wrong, they're different. And here's the thing. For anyone who's watched David Attenborough and his programmes on primates and monkeys, difference is dangerous. Because that means that you're from the tribe down the road. And if that tribe down the road decides that it wants our feeding grounds, or the males in that tribe decide they want to attack the male alpha chimp in my troop, they're going to not only wipe out that male, not only get you out the breeding grounds, but they are going to kill all the babies that are currently being nurtured. So there's millions and millions and millions and millions of years of evolution that drive us to spot difference.
That's really interesting, Stephen. So what you're saying, and I think, do all of us get this? Because I'd be very interested to know your views on, I mean, do you accept this theory? It sounds very, very plausible to me, in the sense that our sensitivity to the difference, it's kind of a risk elevation, isn't it? Where we see something that is different, you know, we don't necessarily presume good or bad, but we presume it may be worse because it's not us. And therefore,
first of all, we just spot difference. That makes us more alert, because difference could be something positive, because we are carnivores, could be something that we are going to eat, or it could be something that's coming to eat and kill me. That's the really basic subconscious elements going on. The issue then is when you that moves up, that message milliseconds later reaches the higher brain, how do we interpret it? And that's what we've got to look out for. That's what we've got to understand, is how are we interpreting difference? And I always say unconscious bias is not necessarily the issue, because that's just looking at difference. It's conscious bias that says you are different, therefore I'm not going to treat you well, whether that be on the color of your skin or the religion, or even the type of religion out of my own religion, whether you're from that branch of the same religion as I, a different branch from I, if you looked at Northern Ireland, Protestant Catholics, if you look at Muslims, Sunnis and Shiites, it's how we interpret it. Do we interpret that difference as something that we want to use to put people down? Could be gender-based, could be ethnic-based, could be sexuality-based, or do we as a culture say we recognize that we spot difference, but difference is wonderful, difference is great, we embrace difference and we want difference? And that's what society's got to decide. You won't stop until human beings evolve and we get rid of all of these core elements of our brain tissue, we're not going to get rid of that difference element.
All right.
It's how we interpret it.
Charlotte, you're about to say something, is that right? No.
Sorry?
Let me just say something. I thought I interrupted you, but I was going to say something straight away. What prompted me to think about doing this show is the idea that I read a report that there was a lot of unconscious bias training in terms of trying to de-bias people. And the report kind of said, look, A, there's no evidence that it's effective, but B, there's some evidence it might be harmful. In a sense, people rejected it and they ended up doubling down on some of the initial instincts that they had, and it didn't change behavior in any way. And that's what prompted me to think, you know what, how much are we doing a lot of this in HR and recruiting, where we may be trying to wrestle with something that, you know, we really can't defeat and isn't the problem, but there's another way to deal with it. Let's talk about unconscious bias training. What's your verdict on that? Let's go to you first, Evie. Have you tried it? Is it something that's in your sort of career path in any way?
I haven't tried it. I have read a lot of about that. And you know, what is the problem there? Sometimes the organizations, they have these trainings just to tick the box. And this is maybe the first problem. And then the second and biggest problem is that there is no evidence that they support that unconscious bias trainings are effective. And all this has to do with the behavior change. In order to change the behavior is really difficult. So the only effective result after these trainings is that the awareness that is raised to the individuals. Right. However, even after long-term evaluations, people, they haven't changed their behaviors. And this is the problem, the main problem.
Right. So that's really interesting. Basically, if there is a value to unconscious bias training, it isn't necessarily triggering behavioral change, but it is at least to raise the awareness that there is such a thing as unconscious bias. Because I'm sure there's people out there that think they're not biased, right? I mean, you can simply go online anywhere to any kind of argument or conversation, a debate in any comment thread. There'll be folks out there that are just absolutely convinced that, of course, they have, they've got the eye on the truth, and they're not subject to these biases. So I think there is a kind of an idea that, unconscious bias is still a reasonably marginal idea. But the training, if it has some value, is to say, you know what, this is part of how we've evolved as human beings. We've got to accept this part of who we are. The question is, okay, what do we then do about it? Because it may be that carrying those biases through without any kind of consciousness could be negative for lots of reasons. Okay, is there kind of an example? I'll go to you with this, Stephen. Is there an example in your experience where training of some type has been useful to de-bias hiring decisions and stuff like this?
Can't think of any. It's not the biases again. It's very interesting that I am a partner of what was the Stephen Lawrence Trust, and I put together the diversity inclusion certification for. I don't know if you know about Stephen Lawrence, but he was a young man who was murdered in a gang-related murder in London, wasn't particularly well investigated by the Metropolitan Police, led to a big investigation, said the Metropolitan Police is institutionally racist. And that's the thing that I keep coming back to. It is not unconscious bias that is the issue. It is the rules and the values of the society around it. Because on anything, in anywhere you go in the world, you're right. People say, it's not me that's biased. It's not me that's a bad interviewer. It's not me, it's everyone else. It's always everyone else that's the problem. It's never me. That's part of the human condition as well. How do you change those issues? You don't get people to look at their unconscious bias. You change society. And that's the thing. You've got to change society so it is unacceptable to have a negative bias based on age or race or gender or what have you, so that people recognize the positives that diversity can bring. That's a much bigger issue. And I think it's this whole industry has appeared saying, oh, we'll run some unconscious bias training. The Stephen Lawrence Foundation will tell you they were doing it 15 years ago and they've stopped doing it. And that is an organization that is all about eradicating racism from society, and it says we don't bother with unconscious bias training anymore. Why not? Because they found it is not effective. Change the values and of the culture of society, then the bias is less likely to be implicitly accepted.
Right.
By society as being reasonable.
So what you're saying, Stephen, this is very interesting, is that the location of the policy needs to be at the unit level, has to be at a higher level than at the individual. Because you can just work on the individual, but ultimately you're going to struggle with it simply because, as Andrew said in the sidebar there, people just double down sometimes on their on the accusation of it. Like, I think a lot of times the word bias doesn't help sometimes because it has connotation. So when I say, oh, Charlotte, you're biased, that may be true, but in the context of our conversation, it might be true, but suddenly it feels like an accusation. And inevitably, if anybody's been accused of something which, you know, we are now thinking is terrible, we are defensive about it, and the barriers come up, and there's no changing anybody who's in that posture of defending. When you're feeling you're being attacked, what you do is try and stop the attack. And you will either attack back or you'll shut down. You're not going to change your behavior, right? That's again human instinct.
I think it's interesting that, you know, we want people to focus on bias, conscious bias or unconscious bias, but we can't force people to interpret behavior all in the same way. And that's a difficult point.
Can you expand a bit on that point? What were you thinking, Charlotte?
So, for example, if you make a hiring decision, you have a group of four people, and you start interviewing a person, and everyone has a different opinion, and everyone has a bias, but we say focus, you know, on being conscious of that bias. But you can't tell people how to interpret behavior. You know, we can't force people to interpret behavior in a certain way in order to avoid bias.
So what are you suggesting? Are you saying that ultimately, I mean, how do we mitigate that? If we locate it down to recruiting, right?
Yeah.
We're hiring somebody. The context is I'm recruiting somebody. Involved in this recruiting is an interview where myself and the person or whoever is involved, the stakeholders are there. We're going to interview this person. How do we mitigate against that? If we're saying that we can't actually change the biases, we might be able to raise awareness in it. Like, does it make any kind of a decision I make kind of corrupted because it's inevitably biased?
That's what I want to ask Stephen. Is there something we can do in order for four people to interpret behavior the same way. It's not possible, right? No. So we're asking the most impossible thing from the interviewing panel.
What? Here's your number one.
Go on.
Your number one thing is the worst identification method in terms of talent is the interview. The interview has been shown to have a predictive power of 56%. 56% of your decisions at, or the of the average interviewer will be good ones. That means that if I take a coin and toss it heads or tails, I'll not be far behind you. You can run your interview panels. You interview 100 people and I'll toss a coin for 100 people. The 50 that I choose are probably going to be just as effective, maybe a tiny bit down on the 50 that you choose. So how do you get rid of that?
Can I just intercede at this point I just want to intercede very quickly and say, please, somebody run a business that does this. I want to see the coin flipping recruiting strategy, and I want to see that tested in the market. Let's see if it actually works. Because I'm kind of up for it. There's another idea in recruiting called open hiring, which is very similar. It's kind of acceptance that you can't actually tell. And the way in which you do it, you simply offer the job to whoever shows up. And you know, it's like, okay, all the energy we're spending trying to figure out whether this person's good or bad, you know what? It's all like, whatever, just bring them in. Anyway,
the US Air Force already did that in the 1960s because they wanted to know if their selection methods were good. So they ran their selection methods, which were multi-methods, but then took all the results and shoved them in a safe. They then literally picked people at random out of their applicant pools. When they went back to the scoring methodology and said, okay, let's look at the people we put in. So half of them got in, would have got in under the assessment methodologies that they had, and half of them would have been rejected. The ones that were rejected, so this is the equivalent of the open hiring, were 7 times more likely to kill themselves in a fatal air crash than the ones they were selected. So they went back, they did exactly that. They went back to the psychologists and said, you know what? Your multi-method assessment methodologies really do work. The ones that passed didn't kill themselves in the planes. The ones that didn't pass did kill themselves. It's not a methodology that this open hiring, New York Fire Brigade did it in the 1970s, same sorts of issues. It only leads to more problems because people get into the job that basically...
They shouldn't be there. Yeah.
So, yeah, it depends on the danger in the job. However, the simple thing is multi-method assessment plus multi-assessor. So, yes, you have an interview. Everyone loves an interview. We expect an interview. You can have that. It's probably your worst predictor out of everything you can possibly do. But on every other thing that people are observed on, they're observed by a different pair of eyes. So that by the time that you get back to the room to just say, well, you saw them in the presentation, you saw them in the interview, you saw them in the group exercise, you saw them in the role play, you've got all of these people coming together, all of whom have got their own biases, but the bias of one generally cancels out the bias of another. Because clearly I'm more biased towards Scottish people, because we're brilliant, than any other nation on the earth. I can't help that. I'm bound to be. We all are. So if there's a Scottish applicant, do you know what? Even as being a psychologist, am I going to be a little bit softer on my assessment? Yes, I am. But the person beside me who did their other exercise is English. They don't have that bias, so it cancels out. So,
all right. So Stephen, sorry to interrupt. Yeah, I want to just step in on this real quick, because it seems to tell me that like the multi-assessment, I think, is a really, really powerful idea. Like, you can't just assess the person on one mechanism and assume that's going to give you the right decision. You've got to do it in multiple ways to assess. And I also like the idea of also randomly picking out from the applicant pool at some time just to compare how your set assessment actually compares to a randomized approach. The multi-assessment, the multi-assessor idea, I think also speaks to the requirement to have a fairly diverse group of people involved in the recruiting process. Because if you had like 20 Scots doing interviewing,
got a problem. do you know what? It's called white jury. It's well known. And I've run the diversity programs for NHS England and for the BBC. And there was a very famous BBC TV news presenter who came through this program. So this was to identify basically minority talent that was hidden within the organization. I always remember saying to me, Stephen, when I brought in all my assessor pool, which were incredibly diverse, she said, I never thought I'd see the day at the BBC where there was one white token male. And I went, yep, that's what we've got. I am the white token male in the assessor pool. If you don't do that, you get white juror syndrome, where you have, say, an Asian female will come in, look at a panel of white Scottish males, and immediately, subconsciously, say, you're not like me. I have no chance and motivation to perform at the interview, the assessment, whatever you're doing, just went through the floor. You have just trashed that person because you haven't got a diverse assessor pool. So that's key, is that the diversity of your assessor pool must reflect the diversity of your applicant pool.
All right, I've got an idea here. Sorry, Charlotte, you're on mute anyway, so I can't interrupt you because I can't even hear you. Here's an idea. So it just occurred to me, okay, what if you had a fairly homogenous company and you have a kind of an intrinsic problem here because you can't easily have a diverse pool, etc., because you don't have the assessors of this type. Now, in that circumstance, I would argue that probably you should lean more heavily towards anonymized sort of assessment technology at that point, because you're more likely to be biased or introducing bias by having a more human intensive one, because all of your assessor panel actually are of a homogenous group. So perhaps the use of the balance of the, so when you talk about multi-assessment, for instance, you've got 10 things you're going to use to assess, you're going to put weightings on different things. But if you haven't got a heterogeneous kind of assessor pool, then you can't really lean that heavily on a heavy human contact type of recruitment process, because it's going to introduce these biases that you mentioned. And by the way, Stephen, you did talk about the white jury syndrome, and there is very good evidence from the legal profession that actually, your conviction rates go up if you're different from the judge. The amount of time you spend in jail or your sentencing is increasing. All of this is like really well established, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You get defendants who, particularly ethnic minority defendants, who are innocent, who walk in and say, change to guilty, because they know that they feel that they're not going to get a fair hearing. So it's not worth putting in the effort. They feel they're going to be guilty anyway, and they know if they plead guilty, they'll get less of a sentence. So that's why it's called white juror syndrome. Yeah. You just look at the jury and go, I'm going to be found guilty anyway. Give up, change my plea to guilty from not guilty. That's where it comes from. Same thing happens in assessments. That is well known. And somebody, I think Michael put it in the thing. You can get there are organizations that will supply external assessors to partner with your internal assessors, so you do a buddy system, and they are from a much wider diverse community.
What are these companies? Michael, share the links to some of these companies. I actually don't know of this category of business. I would love for that to be more widely available and widely known, because I think internal recruiters, external recruiters, whatever, would like to know who these companies are, because it may be something as an additional tool we could bring into play. Because oftentimes,
basically, you've got blueprint for all.
All right. So you're saying there's tons. Michael's saying there's tons. Share the links. I want to see. I want to see the evidence of them. I need to have the resources.
Companies won't pay for it unless you're with a big, heavy-duty company like Outsheaf Psychic Shell. When you've got that kind of budget, you can say, "Yeah, get me as many as you want."
Okay. We have to take a small interlude. We have to take a small interlude because I don't want to bleed too much time on this. We always have a session, by the way, in the middle of this show, where if people who are listening to this, and there's about 80 of you already on Crowdcast, probably 700 on LinkedIn and whatever, if you're interested in this topic and you want to continue it after the show, after sort of our conversation, please use this moment to share your LinkedIn profile in the chat stream now and connect with everyone else that you see on the chat stream. Because these are all folks that are basically interested in this topic. Don't let us be the bottleneck to stop this conversation continuing, because I think it's worth to continue having this chat. So share your LinkedIn in the chat stream now, and make sure you connect with the folks that you see there. Okay, Charlotte, I want to go to you on this, because as an internal recruiter, let's have a think about this circumstance where you have a non-diverse recruiting panel, right? That this may happen, particularly if you're a smallish business going up, for instance, you just don't have the diversity in there. Have you sort of found a way to mitigate that? And what's the challenge of bringing in an external party that you can think of right now?
Well, I haven't heard of the external party, so I'm really interested to look into this option. I truly think, because I work in a heavily white-dominated organization, not proud of it, just started 3 months ago, and it's time to change. However, I do notice that the interviewing is mostly white male-dominated as well. So how do we switch it up? And I noticed that I have a completely different opinion when I've interviewed someone and I pass it on to the next stage, that they have the opposite opinion and they focus on different areas of what they think is important. And in order for there to be alignment, I've been in the clinch with them more often. So how do we create, also that my opinion matters as much as theirs, because they're the hiring manager. They say to me, like, I don't think you might understand what we're looking for exactly, which I do know. However, they see things differently. And it's just the same thing as saying someone needs to have a certain background, such as, coming from Bain or BCG or McKinsey or whatever. That bias is already there.
I think that's also a little bit about ownership of the role as well, isn't it? Like, certain managers in particular can feel very, very precious about total control over who's in their team, for instance.
And that's
that type of psychology, it comes from a source of insecurity at the end, but that type of psychology is going to be very, very tough nut to crack from a kind of a practical point of view.
Letting go of the fact that it doesn't need to be solely white or dominated, but a diverse group is even more, it's so much better, and it creates so much more opportunity, to contribute to the eventual business. And that's something that we need to educate people on.
I might actually do this, because it strikes me that Brain Food is a big enough community for me to be able to hustle up a bunch of people from diverse backgrounds that could potentially step in to do some interviewing or whatnot. Let me know, folks, is this something worth organizing? Because I'm sure there's businesses that do this, but at the same time, you talk about cost, even. Commercialized businesses, there's certain companies simply can't afford to do that, and that's totally fair enough. So maybe we can maybe do it on a pro bono basis or something like this, where, we're getting too many, let's say, too many of this gender of interviewer, assessor. We need to balance that up. Maybe there's going to be people in Brain Food that could step in to do that. I wonder whether that might be a good idea. Anyway, let's move on to talk about technology, because one of the big things that we're trying to do is, we accept that interviewing person to person, there's going to be full of bias either way. It's impossible to get rid of it. Okay, let's throw some technology at it that solves the problem. Where are we sitting with regards to technology? Evie, I'm going to go to you, and that's a bit unfair, no, because you work for a technology provider that's trying to alleviate some of these problems. But also looking at it from your own psychology kind of background, Where do you see technology playing a role here? Where in the process does it work best? What is the expectation we need to have for that technology in order for us to really get a decent result at the end of it?
First of all, I want to state that we can't remove the human element. So definitely we can't do anything, everything with technology. We need technology in order to reduce the bias that we have. And we can use AI. And here at Brick, we offer a great tool and great instrument that can help on that. And it's evidence-based. But at the end, you know, the people are those that they are making the decisions. And when we're talking about, because you mentioned before the interviews, and at some point, we're going to, after using the technology, you're going to have the interview. And there, I want to agree with Stephen, we should use maybe a structured interviews, a panel of people, and many people to see the same person. So I am a strong believer of technology, and I feel that they help us a lot, and we can reduce the bias, definitely.
Yeah, so we can ameliorate the problem, but obviously let's not sort of drink all the ocean in one go, but technology can definitely be better than rewind the clock what it was before, you know, sending in a letter, getting an interview face-to-face. Before all of technology really happened, it was very much a human-driven process. I remember even sort of when I was a graduate going into interviews and stuff like this, it was just a gut instinct all the way through. You know, there wasn't any kind of pretense of anything else. Charlotte, go to you on this. Implementation of technology, assessment technology, how big a component does this play in reducing the risk of unconscious bias affecting bad decisions in the hiring process?
It's an interesting one. I haven't used technology, to be honest. And again, AI is built out of data that comes from us. So we need a massive data set in order to make sure that it's, you know, not biased AI. I would love to explore someone who is an expert at it and who has implemented a platform or a tool that significantly proved that the outcome of the hire was best, or for example, also with regards to retention. There's so many elements that we need to take into account.
You know, Charlotte,
interesting topic. Yeah, go on.
We had a business study recently with a huge of one of our biggest customers. So they're using us for a year now. So we did a business case just between the two organizations in order to understand how they reduce the bias and how maybe they are more diverse after using our tool. So the results showed that after using the tool, they improved and they were 119% more diverse than before. And that's an excellent finding if you consider that before that, you know, we are biased. We mentioned that even a name can create biases. Then the gender and all those sort of things. So how we can remove them? So anonymization that we mentioned before is a tool. We can anonymize the information. If we don't see the name, we can go one step closer to removing biases. The second step is how we can do it more objectively. So we have the tool that we're using. We have an assessment. It's objective because the hiring manager is not able to see first the name. They're not seeing the names, and they just see the results. We assess cognitive ability and personality, which are the best predictors of job performance. So if you have this information in front of you, you don't see the name, you go to the next step, having, let's say, 10 people in the next step of the hiring process, that they're assessed objectively.
Well, what does that look like? What does the hiring manager literally see?
They see only the results of the assessment. They don't see anything.
What is an example of the results?
Charlotte, you can get the demo from Brick later.
Sorry.
Brick.com, it's there. But I think to intercede here, basically what it is like you're getting rid of the names, you're getting rid of personal, like a demographic identifiers, you're just getting the outcome of their assessments. And then the hiring manager has to make those decisions, or maybe there's simply an automated bar where they can say, you know what, above 59 or whatever, everyone gets into the next stage. And then everyone gets into the next stage, there will be a more diverse group of people, and it would be a case if you were just doing a CV screen. And that situation is where you do the multi-assessor approach, and where you try and do the diversification of who's actually going to be doing the interviewing and all the rest of it, and maybe some other stuff. Like, we talked about interviewing as being one of the tools, but there's functional exercises you can do, there's in-work stuff that you can do. Remote working is going to help, because maybe it's project work you can get involved in some respect, that can help build relationships in a more contextualized way. All of those things may be of use. Okay, we're running short on time, folks, so I'm going to just quickly finish off with a question. Actually, no, we're going to hit the questions now, so everyone pay attention to this. Lee is saying, Stephen, do you play golf? Stephen, you've got to say yes. Having basically lived in St. Andrews, you've got to say yes to that. Okay, let's go to Andrew Barr. Andrew is saying, where do we stand on training then? Because if we accept that training is not going to solve the problem, so we accept this, but does it still have a value if it raises awareness that unconscious bias is a thing? Let's go one-to-one on this. Ebby, go to you on this. Training. So one-to-one training, is a diversity trainer coming in. Good idea or not?
I know that it's not effective as a result, but we need to raise awareness. So I am in on that. And I would say that we should continue, but we should implement evidence-based trainings.
Yep.
In okay, order good. To avoid the backfire results.
Yeah, yeah. And also to avoid the checkbox mentality to say, we've trained exactly. everyone. Let's go exactly. back to where we were. Okay. Yeah. How about you, Charlotte? Give me a yes, no on this training. Is it a good idea or not?
Yes.
It is good. Well,
you want the yes or no, right?
Yeah. No, you've given me exactly what I asked for, so I can't complain with that. Okay, Stephen, finally to you. I know you've criticized it hugely. What's your final take on training? Does it have any value, or is it counterproductive in some way?
Possibly. Depends who you're training and the context within which you're training. And more importantly, what the organization is going to do after the training. That's what's probably more important.
Outcomes afterwards. Yeah. Is there a planned sort of outcome from the training? So you can't just deliver, you can't just treat it as a knowledge drop. It has to be something going on further forward. Okay. I tell you what, we're hearing a lot of, have you seen how many comments on the chat bar saying, show me the diversity panel business? It's like, no one knows about these services. They literally need to do a better PR job. But maybe we can do a brain food stopgap on this. Okay, that's about it, folks. I think we've come to the end of time. This has been an absolutely fascinating topic, hasn't it? And I think we've learned a huge amount. And I really hope that we've got a lot more to go. Like what I've taken from this conversation from the panel here is that we need to deepen our knowledge as to human psychology. And not have in kind of a unrealistic expectation as to what can be achieved. We have to accept that we are evolved human beings, that we're biological entities that are subject to Darwinian principles. And that's the starting point. That's not bad. We need to understand the word bias has connotation and perhaps change the language or change the connotation. But we also need to think, okay, what can we do to mitigate at whatever level we have. Charlotte, you're about to say something, I think, or not?
No.
No?
I was reading all the comments. It's very...
Okay.
I enjoy everyone's opinions.
Cool. All right. That's about it, everybody. Thank you so much for your time. Stephen Smith, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great your unique contribution. We'll bring you back if you're up for it, Stephen.
Oh, please do. And I'll talk about golf.
We'll have to set aside... We'll have to set aside another topic for that. Stephen, have a very good day, sir.
You too. Thank you for having
me. Oh, there we go. Evie, thank you so much for joining us. It's been wonderful having you. We'll hopefully get you back for another show. It doesn't have to be a Brick-related one, but I love your insight. Yeah. But I also love the fact that, you got different types of people in recruitment technology. I think that's a really important thing. That's another diversity aspect that I think should be really underlined a bit more. So great to have you on, Evie.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Great.
Take care. Bye.
Cool. Bye. And Charlotte, you got people to recruit. So thank you so much for your time.
Did I do okay? Did I do okay?
Did Charlotte do okay, folks? I mean, I always say whoever replaces Adam is an upgrade. But, you know, would you say Charlotte is this way or
what's
that way?
What's the bias? Is it biased or not?
Is biased? I thought you did more than okay. And in fact, it was really interesting just hearing your perspective as a recruiter as well. It's the reason why I wanted you here is because both Evie and Stephen aren't like doing the recruiting. I'm not doing the recruiting anymore. So it's important that we have someone who's actually doing the work because there's practical conditions as well. Like sometimes in Brain Food Live, we get kind of, we float off into the abstract and we kind of say things as they should be. And obviously there's a world of shoulds, but there's also a world of practical issues that we have to deal with. And there's practical stuff. There's a business, there's deadlines, there's resources, you have to make some money. You know, all of these things are very, very important. Okay, Charlotte, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to say goodbye to you. We'll catch up soon. Hopefully we're probably overdue for a lunch or a dinner or something like that. Did I pay last time or did is it on?
No, we split. We went Dutch.
Dutch. We'll do Dutch again.
All right. Cheers. Thanks, guys.
See you later, Charlotte. Cheers.
Bye.
Cool. Wasn't that great, folks? What a great show. And more or less on time as well. Usually we go like way over. But I had to cut it down to about 65 minutes, which I think is about right. So listen, if you've enjoyed this show, follow the channel. We do this every week. We've got another amazing show for you next week. It's kind of a similar theme. So we've got a bit of a theme going through. It's where does culture fit in the current hiring process? Culture fit as the single term, I think, has been massively discredited. Okay, fair enough. But is there something about hiring people that do mesh with the existing culture you have, that are not overly disruptive, that can come in and actually contribute positively? Do we still have that vibe? And if so, how do we focus on it? And how do we actually recruit against it? It's going to be super interesting. So make sure you register for that as well. And we also have a Founders Focus next week. We're speaking to the good folks at Willow. They do interview assessments. So again, we're thinking about how do we improve our hiring processes. That will be on Thursday, I believe. So anyway, that's about it. You have a good weekend. I'll see you next week.